This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
Welcome to the AJ Podcast. I'm your host, Emily Slofstra, Associate Web Editor at Alternatives Journal, Canada's environmental voice. Thanks for tuning in to the second podcast for our Greenbelts issue. To listen to the first podcast on Greenbelts, or any of our past audio, visit alternativesjournal.ca/podcasts. This edition of the podcast features two interviews. The first is with Jed Goldberg, President of Earth Day Canada, about their challenge to Canadians in the month of April. Earth Day Canada hopes to see Canadians taking more steps to reduce their carbon footprint, and they've created a checklist with environmental tasks or actions that can be completed each day of the month. To see the checklist, visit earthday.ca or check out Earth Day Canada on Facebook. Jed and I chatted about the two sets of challenges for both kids and adults, that if you complete, you might be entered to win great prizes. The second interview I did was with Katarina Zizek, director of the interactive documentary High Rise. Our editor Eric Rumble did an interview with Kat in the current issue, which can be found on page 14 of the magazine. I followed up with her to chat about the High Rise project as a whole, as well as to learn more about the latest part of the project on the history of high rises. Kat will be working with the OpDoc section of the New York Times and the National Film Board to create four short films with images from the archives of New York City, as well as submitted photos from high rise dwellers around the world. To learn more about the history of the High Rise Project and to engage with the completed interactive docs Out My Window and 1 Millionth Tower, visit highrise.nfb.ca. This podcast starts with the song Mountaintop from Blackwood 2, who can be found busking around Toronto on a regular basis and will be playing shows and festivals across Canada this summer. They can be found at theblackwood2.com. Between interviews, we have a spoken word piece from Janice Lee on commitment and community, and one of her songs finishes the show after Kat's interview. Janice is currently on tour across the prairies in BC. Find her tour dates and Poetry Slam appearances at janicejolee.ca. That's Janice, JOLEE.ca. Here's Jed Goldberg on Earth Day Canada's challenge to Canadians.
So Earth Day Canada is running a challenge in April?
Yes, we are sending a challenge in April. It's called Act for the Planet. And it's really trying to equip people across the country with specific tasks that they can do one day, each day of the month in the month of April. And all of these things hopefully will create the opportunity for them to change their behavior. Because we know from studies that that have been done that sometimes it takes 30 days of repetition before before that kind of behavioral change gets ingrained. So, you know, we're reaching out both to kids and to adults with this program. We have a separate version for kids. So we're very excited about it because it really does kind of answer the what can I do question that does paralyze a lot of people. So we're giving people tangible actions. We'll facilitate and help them along the way. And hopefully this will, you know, generate a lot of change in people's attitudes and behaviors in future.
Yeah, I hope so as well. So the checklist will be posted on April 1st, right?
Yes.
And what are some of the examples of actions that will be on that checklist?
Well, in essence, we've broken it up into sort of themes, you know, talking about things you can do in your home. And they're very basic things, you know, getting rid of some toxic cleaning products. And we recommend ways that you can actually make your own, reducing the amount of energy that you're using, cleaning and sort of getting rid of items that are no longer of any real value to you anymore, and great ways to do that. Also, sort of body care things that need to be considered. So, you know, so many of the products that you buy in stores are full of all kinds of dangerous and toxic ingredients that can accumulate in your body, and many are carcinogenic. So we have a lot of ideas on what you can do to change the way that you buy personal care products. Also, transportation, ways that you can get outside and get a little bit more exercise while using active transportation, and then food-related actions as well. So hopefully people will see these actions. And, you know, even if they do a few, it's getting them on the path anyway. And that's really the objective, is giving people a bit of a kickstart.
Right. And is it mostly actions that decrease individual footprints, or will there also be some actions that, say, ask individuals to write letters about different things or participate in demonstrations, that kind of thing?
Both.
Both?
It's both. So there are actions there, you know, where people can express their views on particular environmental issues and, you know, contact decision makers and hopefully make them aware that there's a lot of people in this country that want things done differently. And mostly, though, it's personal behavior.
Right.
So that's where the bulk of the actions come from.
Are any actions directly tied to Earth Day?
No, okay. Surprisingly. None of them are directly tied to Earth Day. To be honest, we don't want people to think that April 22nd is the day. You know, we are an organization that's active all year round, and environmental action and environmental mobility shouldn't happen just 1 hour or 1 day a year. It's something that we have to ingrain into our daily lifestyle. So, no, this is not an Earth Day specific thing. We're hoping that this is something that people can fold into their daily routines.
That's great. I live in an urban homestead, so we do this sort of thing every day, and I'm looking forward to the checklist to see if there's anything that I can also improve on. And I'm sure that AJ staff will also be participating.
Oh.
I'm sure we'll be blogging about it and sharing what our challenges are and what we're enjoying. Are there any areas that you'll be focusing on personally?
Probably. Certainly I'm going to try and make my own toothpaste, which is something I've never done before, but that should be kind of fun.
Yeah. I did a workshop on that at Hillside Festival last year.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
In Guelph?
Yes, yeah.
Oh, okay.
So that went over pretty well. People were pretty excited about it. It's very simple, but it's great. I use it all the time now, so.
You know, there's lots of little things that people can get involved in, and it can even be something as small as just educating yourself.
Right.
So, you know, there's some great websites out there. There's one called Films for Action that have all kinds of environmentally themed documentaries that are full of information, and they also give people very good direction. So making people aware and understand what the issues are is another one of the actions, too.
Great. So will you be keeping track of participants, and are there any prizes or anything that go along with it?
Yes, there are incentives and prizes, and we will be tracking the progress of how the campaign is going, and all of that information will be on our website.
Great. So I have a 13-year-old at home, so I'm curious more about the details of the Kids Challenge.
Okay.
So there's 5 different things that kids can do?
Yeah. One of them is having them grow sprouts. Having them reconnect with nature. So too many kids are plugged in these days, with TV and computers and video games and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And we really want them to turn these things off and go outside. It's better for their bodies and their minds, but it's also much better for the environment. And hopefully if they do go outside and they're involved in playing outdoors, maybe they'll get a better appreciation of nature as well. We also want to have kids develop their activist side a little bit as well. So we have information on how even very young kids can start up an anti-idling campaign. We want them to understand reuse, the ethic and value of reuse rather than recycling. So we have information on how they can set something up in their school or at their home around that theme. And also easy ways for people to build some habitat for wildlife, even in your backyard. So those are the areas that we focus on with the Kids Challenge.
Great. And there's pretty cool prizes that I saw for the kids as well.
Yeah, we're very lucky that Sony has donated a lot of prizing, and there's some great incentives for people to be involved in the campaign there.
And do they have to provide proof that they've completed their actions to be entered in the draw?
We go on the honor system.
Okay.
So we're hoping that people are straight with us, and I'm sure they will be.
But I'm sure if people were super excited about their sprouts, they could post it on your Facebook page.
Well, what we would really love is if they could email us pictures or videos.
Okay, and where would they email that to?
They could just email that to info@earthday.ca.
Cool.
And, visuals can be a very, very strong motivator for other people. So we want as many visuals as we can. So, if you're in the act of doing something green, have somebody document that and send that in to us, and hopefully it'll end up on our website.
Great. Would you say there's one particular or a couple particular actions that are the most important that people should take and focus on for the month?
Well, to be honest with you, the most important thing is that people get involved. And I don't want to sort of point to one or two or three and say these are the key ones that you need to do. A lot of them are related to climate change and reducing our energy use, and others are involved in proper food choices and being a conscious consumer. All of these things are important, and the most important thing is that they just try, they get involved, and they try and complete a number of these actions.
Great. I'm sure lots of people will be getting involved then.
We hope so.
Is there anything else you'd like to add about the challenge?
I guess the only other thing I'd want to add is that we do have a ton of material on our website at earthday.ca. And if anyone has any questions, the information is there. It explains what all the challenges are. And we really encourage people to get involved because we need to have campaigns that show how dedicated people are to changing the environment and making our decision makers understand that this is a very, very important issue that's been shirked for too long.
Well, thanks a lot, Jed.
Thank you for your time.
You're listening to the AJ Podcast. That was an interview with Jed Goldberg talking about how he hopes Canadians will act for the planet this April. Visit earthday.ca or find Earth Day Canada on Facebook to see how you can make a difference for the environment. To follow along with AJ staff as they undertake challenges throughout the month, visit alternativesjournal.ca/blogs. To learn more about AJ, find a copy of the magazine on newsstands or visit alternativesjournal.ca. Here's KW's spoken word artist, Janice Lee, with On Commitment and Community. Janice just embarked on a West Coast tour of spoken word and solo musical shows. Check out her tour dates for April and May 2013 at janicejolie.ca. Her piece is followed by an interview with Kat Zizek on the interactive documentary series High Rise.
I am a tree. My roots run deep. And when you pollute this soil, it's my feet that bleed. If a storm comes, I don't run. I brace myself with support from these legs, these pegs sewn down deep through sunsets and sunrises. Many seasons it's taken to learn the faces around, my neighboring plants, the lowlifes, insects, and dirt crawlers, the high flyers, the birds, and traveling winds. Storms I have weathered, toughened my skin. In the sun, I have bloomed and exploded into color. I stand here committed to grow is my fervor. But I only grow with support from my neighbors. The traveling winds, they tempt me with exciting stories from places not near. But what they don't understand, I fear, is that I'm committed to this ground right here. I have debts to the rains that have watered my soul and refilled the deepest of my wells, drained dry from quenching others' cracked hearts, needing constant soothing that there is richness in the depths of this soil. There is comfort in the grooves of my trunk. There is shelter in the branches of my bunks. I have cleared my tears through the tips of my fingers, drip dropping down, seeping into the ground. I have struggled against new structures around me, bricks and benches, walls and fountains implanted above my far-reaching roots. My bark has been shaved, my ties have been cut, my ground has been stomped upon by tractors and boots. The wind tosses me, twirls me in a dance, and as my leaves prance, I glance a gleam of freedom. Oh, how I would bounce if I could, shake the earth below with my bounds, swim in the lake I have only ever seen from the tip-tops of my breezy treetops. But with my toes wrapped in weeds and crisscrossing roots, I can't hop to the latest trendy spot, though the winds tell me of great things there. No, instead I stay. I feed and fed, I grow, 'cause I know everything I've worked for is by my side, this ground, right here. Yes, I am bound, I am heavy, I see. And freedom? Well, that's just a myth to me. For how could I be free out there without my joy, my friends? How could I be free out there without my pain, the rain? Is freedom simply a lack of commitment or a space to struggle, a space to grow? For I am a tree. My roots run deep. Bind me with bugs, structures, and flowers. Tease me with winds, birds, and showers. My back will not crack, though sometimes I bleed. I will grow with my friends up high and low. Together we'll sow. Together we'll grow.
So you are the director of the interactive and collaborative documentary High Rise?
Yes, at the National Film Board of Canada.
Right. And you were previously the filmmaker in residence?
Exactly, yeah. The first project that I did with the board from 2004 to 2008 was called Filmmaker in Residence, and out of that sort of talks grew, and a new project emerged called High Rise, which is what we're doing now.
Cool. And there's a new part of that project that you're working on with the New York Times now?
Yeah, we just announced it at South by Southwest a little more than 2 weeks ago, and it's a really exciting collaboration between High Rise and several departments of the New York Times, actually, but our host there is the New York Times Op Docs section, which is a wonderful new, fairly new feature. It's been around for about a year, headed up by Jason Spingenkopf, who basically runs point-of-view documentaries, short documentaries. I think he's put up over 55 of them now. And he approached us, and sort of talks grew into a much larger project where we're doing a three-part series on the history of the high-rise. And we're also working with the social media department. We've put a call out to readers around the world to submit photos of their own lives in high-rises. And out of that, we'll create a fourth film, which is like a people's history of the high-rise building.
That sounds great. I'm looking forward to checking that out when it's out. When will it be completed, do you think?
Oh, it's a good question. We're working on it right now, and we're hoping to get it out as fast as we can.
So it's an interactive project again, right?
It is. Yeah, it's built on the foundation of four short films, but we will sort of embed them into an interactive experience so that you can dig down into specific materials and learn a little bit more. But if you just want to watch a film, you can also do that. But if you want to kind of learn more and play with the animation a bit, you can do that. And it's kind of like it's almost built on storybook formats on iPads. You know, those kids' books that are, they just do so well on that format, that tactile capacity of the tablet. So we're sort of playing on that theme, and I built the film out of the photos, undigitized photo archive of the New York Times that's affectionately known as the morgue. It's 5 to 6 million photographs that they've collected over the years that they've been publishing that they have not digitized yet. And so I spent a week down there looking at the folders of buildings and came up with the idea of three films that sort of chart the three different ages, I call them, of the history of the high-rise building.
Cool. That sounds like it would have been quite enlightening.
Oh, huge. Yeah, so amazing. It's like three stories underground. There's no internet down there. There's no cellular connection. So you're really kind of like time warped back into 1995 and just amongst all these files and filing cabinets. And yeah, it sort of brought me back to my old newspaper days. It was just so fascinating to uncover these photos, many of which have just not been seen for decades.
So the other night, my partner was telling me about how a lot of the first high-rises in New York and I think Chicago were built by Mohawks.
Yeah, that's very true. I mean, those are mostly the skyscrapers. This project specifically focuses on residential high-rises, but of course, the engineering would have been inspired by some of those buildings that were built out of sort of steel frames, and a lot of the Mohawks from Ganawage, actually, which is a First Nations community just outside of Montreal. When I used to live in Montreal and worked in Ganawage, I met a lot of the people that had worked and built much of New York. So, yeah, absolutely incredible story. And there's also a great National Film Board of Canada film about Mohawks building New York, so people should check that out.
So that's something that I thought was interesting. Were there any other surprises or particularly interesting facts or photos that you came across in your research?
It's funny because I've been studying and researching high-rises for over 5 years now, and they just never cease to excite me and surprise me in all their myriad of sort of different ways in which they express themselves around the world. And what's so fun about this project has been kind of digging deep into across the globe and into different times and different areas to see how vertical living shapes and defines our social structures. And so that's kind of the lens that I took on this is, yes, it's about architecture, but it's more about what we choose to build and how that reflects how we feel about each other. And what's so remarkable about the history of the high-rise is this incredible effort in the 20th century to create public housing. There's this notion around the world that the state had a responsibility. We collectively had a responsibility to house ourselves. And that is such a fantastically interesting history to me, because that has all but disappeared in many, many parts of the world as the highly privatized, developer-driven model of building condos sort of takes over the way that the new city is being built now.
I actually have a question about gentrification, and I was wondering if you've come across gentrification in your work or if you've focused on that in any way.
Oh, definitely. There's that's one of the big stories of our time. I think, you know, as that dream of housing for all sort of began to crumble in the 70s and 80s, around the time when the Berlin Wall crumbled as well. And we did abandon to a large extent, not everywhere in the world. I mean, Singapore and Hong Kong, for example, still continue to successfully build public housing on mass scale. But in many parts of the world around the 70s and 80s, there was this what we called the donut effect, and people fled the centers of the cities, and now, you know, 40, 50 years later, people are coming back, and that's changing the dynamic of many high-rise neighborhoods where people are getting pushed out of once affordable space. And we see this globally. I mean, this is a trend that's certainly happening in many of the developing world as well. For example, huge trends like that with the clearance of informal settlements in places like Mumbai and Nairobi, also Istanbul, you know, where there's a huge history of squatting. Much of Istanbul was created by people coming in and just building their own housing. And a lot of it was actually vertical, if not quite high-rise, and certainly one floor on top of the other. And that stuff is getting cleared out, and people are being often forcibly moved to high-rise developments way outside of the city. So as the real estate prices start looking more interesting, the big question remains, you know, who is the city for? Who is the downtown core for? And it's a big question that we all face, and that's why I think that urban planning, which is sort of seen as something unsexy or uninteresting, is actually one of the most important things that we need to embrace and understand if we're to become citizens of our cities and of our world and have a say in how we organize ourselves in the future.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And of course, here at Alternatives, we would all agree, because we're seeing urban planning being tied to environmental planning a lot more.
Exactly, yeah.
But it's often unfortunate, because a lot of the sort of eco-friendly developments I can think of, especially high-rises, they're often the ones that are the most unaffordable. So we're building these buildings that are supposed to be better for the environment, but no one really wants to live in them. Or they're putting in, like, ground level shops so that they claim to be a community, but people still aren't talking to their neighbors, and there's still a lot of problems that hopefully people can start to deal with.
Yeah, well, for sure. There's certainly issues of class and income levels and the growing gap between the rich and the poor, and that's certainly another huge thing that we sort of tackle in these little short films about how tracing the history of the high-rise building really traces the history of social equity and social inequity across the ages. And if we look at what's happening right now, it's not too pretty. It's not a very pretty picture in terms of defending and maintaining social equity in our cities.
And have you looked at the environmental footprint of high-rises?
One of the things that I've certainly been very, very inspired by is the work of Graham Stewart, who is an architect here in Toronto, whose work really inspires much of high rise as a whole. And he his area of expertise is really looking at the post-war modernist apartment building, and instead of tearing it down, maybe looking at how, as it comes to the end of its first life, how it can be more sustainably and environmentally treated, so that it becomes less of an energy hog and becomes more also socially sort of better designed, so that people do get to know their neighbors, and there's lots of ways in which the community can form by rethinking the base. You know, a lot of these are tower in the park structures. Here in Toronto, we have 1,189 high-rise buildings, more than any other city outside of Manhattan in North America. And so he's been looking for or finding really interesting examples of what he calls tower renewal, and how that might be applied to the North American context. Most of the successful cases of tower renewal are happening in Europe, some in Eastern Europe, for example, in Prague. There's been some really great examples in East Germany, in London, and you know, his message is that we can take some of those ideas and really successfully apply them here on across all levels: environmental, social, political, re-stitching back sections and neighborhoods of the city that have really fallen away in terms of transport and being connected to the fabric of the rest of the city. So, yeah, really, really inspired by his work.
Do you have any other inspirations?
The residents of the buildings themselves. A lot of, most of the work that we've done, we've tried to really amplify and listen And work with the people who live in the buildings. You know, too often it's central planning or urban planning can have lofty goals and lofty ideals, or even just, you know, a very straightforward sort of private development approach really ignores the voices of the people who know best about what works in these buildings and what doesn't, and that's the people who live there themselves. So part of this project is about participatory media making and participatory city building, so that the voices of the residents, who I'm extremely inspired by, come into that collective discussion.
Great. Yeah, I really enjoyed some of the videos with the animations of showing what the area around the high-rise could look like and connecting different high-rises so that people talk to people in other high-rises. And there's a lot of really great things that are going on, it seems.
Yeah. The residents, in particular the community that we've been working with here in Toronto on Kipling Avenue, they've really come a long way since we first started working there. There's a very active tenants association, and the United Way has set up a tower neighborhood renewal office there. So there's lots and lots going on, and it's in huge part due to the energy and the efforts and the incredible talents and resources of the residents themselves.
So will you be working on the topic of high-rises for long-term, or...?
At least another year. We've got this New York Times project, and then we have another major project where I'm working with a geographer at University of Toronto. Her name is Professor Deborah Cowan, along with a PhD named Emily Paradis. And together we're working on a project called Digital Citizenship in the Global Suburbs. So looking at how people navigate their digital lives within the context of high-rise buildings, which is really proving to be incredibly exciting and insightful, and very excited about that project as well.
Sounds interesting. I'm sure we'll have to be in touch to get more information about that in the future.
I would love to.
Is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners?
Well, just that how much I love your magazine. I'm actually originally from Waterloo, so I've been a big fan of your magazine for many years.
Well, we're glad to hear that.
Well, thanks again for your interest.
Yeah, so thank you for doing this great work.
That was Katarina Zizek talking about the National Film Board's documentary series High Rise, a multi-year experiment about the human experience in vertical suburbs. Visit highrise.nfb.ca to engage with some of the completed documentaries and to learn more about the upcoming short films on the history of the high-rise. You're listening to the AJ Podcast, and I'm Emily Slofstra. Visit us online at alternativesjournal.ca or find us on Twitter or Facebook at AlternativesJ. If you're a musician who sings about the environment that would like to be featured on the podcast, email Emily at alternativesjournal.ca. Here's singer-songwriter Janice Lee with Will You Go?
You have never, ever, long as I know, done me wrong. But here we are, drifting apart. And here we are, silently breaking our hearts. Knowing it was over long ago, but not letting go. You go. Big and subtle ways.